KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump promised to stop a Japanese company from buying U.S. steel. He changed his mind, but has yet to share details about what the deal says. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Did Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency make anything more efficient? I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm Leila Faldin in Budapest. We're reporting on Hungary's populist prime minister, who many Republicans admire. Viktor Orban chipped away at the independence of the judiciary by stacking it with loyalists. We hear from one Hungarian judge who experienced the erosion of judicial independence firsthand. It's Friday, May 30th. Hungarian singer-songwriter Balázs Farkas-Janzer turns 35 today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Supreme Court has ruled President Trump can temporarily pause protections against deportation for about 500,000 migrants in the U.S. People from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela had been given temporary protected status to avoid war or natural disasters in their home countries. The Supreme Court's decision means the migrants would lose their status to stay in the U.S. legally. A federal appeals court has temporarily restored President Trump's ability to impose his sweeping global tariffs. The president's power had been briefly halted earlier this week by lower court decisions. The tariffs can go forward. But NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports Trump is creating more tariff uncertainty today with fresh online comments.
Trump had imposed 145% tariffs on Chinese imports, but earlier this month, the countries announced a 90-day deal lowering those tariffs to 30%. And Chinese tariffs on U.S. goods to 10%. In today's post, Trump took credit for that pause and the positive response from global markets. But the president added that China, quote, has totally violated its agreement with us. He ended, so much for being Mr. Nice Guy. Trump did not specify how China had violated the agreement, nor if any immediate steps are planned. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
The Israeli government has approved the establishment of 22 new settlements throughout the occupied West Bank. The announcement comes as the Israeli military continues to increasingly displace Palestinians from their towns and villages. NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi reports.
The Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz called it a, quote, once-in-a-generation decision that would strengthen the government's hold on the West Bank. Israel captured the territory in the 1967 Mideast War and has built more than 100 Jewish settlements. The international community considers the settlements illegal or illegitimate. Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich is a far-right settler and has been calling for the full annexation of the West Bank. His group believes that all of Israel has been given to the Jewish people by God. Rights groups say the recent move by the government deepens the Israeli occupation and hinders prospects of a two-state solution. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
It's been 2 weeks since a group of 10 prisoners escaped a jail in New Orleans. All but two of the prisoners have been recaptured. Louisiana State Police Colonel Robert Hodges says officials believe the two prisoners are getting help.
Multiple individuals who aided these fugitives after their escape have been arrested. I want to be clear, anyone who chooses to help the remaining fugitives in any way will be arrested and prosecuted.
That audio is courtesy of WVUE. Authorities are now offering a reward of up to $50,000 for each escaped inmate. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down by about 30 points. This is NPR. President Trump says he'll have a press conference early this afternoon at the White House with a handful of reporters and billionaire Elon Musk. It's Musk's last day as a special federal government employee. He oversaw Trump's cost-cutting entity, Doge. Musk says he's returning to his businesses. One of them, automaker Tesla, saw sales plunge in the most recent quarter by 71% year over year. The latest winner of the Scripps National Spelling Bee has been crowned. The Bee is celebrating its 100th year, and NPR's Amy Held reports the winner is a contestant who got another chance to compete for the championship.
A Claire C. Small. E-C-L-A-I-R-C-I-S-S-E-M-E-N-T.
Faizan Zaki fell down as confetti rained down.
overwhelmed with his win.
Somebody peel him off the floor.
The 13-year-old can spell words, but struggled to find words.
I don't know what to say. I'm just really happy.
Éclaircissement means a clearing up. And in his fourth competition, the 7th grader from the Dallas area cleared up any doubts, moving from 370th place in 2019 to runner-up last year. This year, he prevailed over 3 days, 21 rounds, and nearly 250 contestants. Scripps is marking a century of spelling since 1925, inspiring word nerds from around the world. Amy Held, NPR News.
There are reports of a possible tornado in Kentucky south of Louisville. There are reports of damage and injuries. Several people have already died this month in Kentucky tornadoes. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, Elon Musk fired a government worker. Himself. We have an evaluation of his efforts at efficiency. First, President Trump travels to Pittsburgh today to celebrate something he previously said he would not allow. It's a partnership between United States Steel and the Japanese company Nippon Steel. Former President Biden blocked that sale on national security grounds. Candidate Trump also promised to block it, saying that foreign ownership of a company with United States in the name just sounded psychologically bad. Here he was campaigning in Pennsylvania last October.
And I will not approve Japan buying U.S. Steel 70 years ago, the greatest company anywhere in the world.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith is here. Tam, good morning.
Good morning.
Why say yes now?
Well, there had been signs that President Trump was taking a second look at this planned acquisition. It came up when the Japanese prime minister visited the White House in February. And then last month, President Trump ordered a new national security review. Then last week, he announced he was on board with the deal in a social media post, saying it would add $14 billion to the U.S. economy and create 70,000 jobs. And significantly, he described it as a, quote, planned partnership that will keep the headquarters of U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh.
Okay, so we have a social media post, but what are the details here?
We don't have many. The White House didn't respond to a list of basic questions about the structure of the deal. And when I asked a U.S. Steel spokesman whether it was an acquisition, he said he was unable to comment and directed me to a week-old statement where the company praised President Trump and said U.S. Steel will remain American, grow bigger and stronger through a partnership with Nippon Steel. So I called a bunch of industry analysts whose job it is to advise investors, and they said they haven't been able to get clear answers either. But all along, Nippon has made it clear that they aren't going to make this kind of investment unless they are acquiring U.S. Steel and its assets. Gordon Johnson is CEO of GLJ Research.
No matter how the government and or the non-answers from U.S. Steel want to position this, let me be very clear. This is an acquisition. It's very clearly an acquisition.
And given the expected purchase price, he says it is a very good deal for U.S. Steel shareholders and executives. Another analyst I spoke to said their best interpretation of the facts is that Trump is calling it a partnership to avoid looking like he reversed himself on this. And another, Phil Gibbs at KeyBank Capital Markets, put it this way.
It has to be purposely opaque because there have been so many missteps, misfires, lawsuits, political interference. And then we finally get to what looks like a conclusion, and we're even questioning the conclusion.
I will also note that U.S. Steel hasn't filed anything with the Securities and Exchange Commission about this latest version of the deal.
Tam, first, thanks very much for the reporting. I appreciate your look on the at the substance here. It really helps me. Second, I want to talk about the politics. Last fall, we talked with people in Western Pennsylvania where there are U.S. Steel plants who thought this deal was good. Even the local union guys thought the deal was good, but there was this national opposition in the middle of the campaign. So why would he promote the deal in such a big way now?
You know, a major theme of the first few months of his second term has been bringing foreign investment to the U.S., onshoring manufacturing, creating American jobs. And there are a few things that he relishes more than announcing a deal. Hmm. Pennsylvania, of course, is also a state that delivered him the presidency. So he's going to call it a win. But as you know, maybe it's popular locally, but the United Steelworkers Union is quite dubious of this announcement and what it will mean in the end for jobs. Democratic politicians from the state are offering very tentative statements saying the devil is in the details and they don't yet have the details.
NPR's Tamara Keith will be traveling with the president to Pittsburgh today. Tam, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Elon Musk says he is leaving his government role as the leader of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. The head of Tesla and SpaceX and X will join President Trump at the White House this afternoon. NPR's Stephen Fowler has been covering DOGE all along, and he's on the line. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, does Musk stepping away change anything about what the Department of Government Efficiency will do?
Not really. I mean, he's been touted by President Trump and others as the leader in DOGE. In court, lawyers for the government have said he's not, and they've downplayed his role. But the reality is much of the DOGE work, I mean, the parts that haven't been reversed or held up in court, have always been carried out by people not named Elon Musk. These allies are embedded in agencies more permanently. Many of them are full-on federal employees, and they're more focused on specific goals at those agencies.
Stephen, I followed all your reporting on this. A lot of DOGE's claims of savings and changes were illusory or have been reversed, as you just mentioned, but they're still out there acting, so what could they continue to do?
Well, there have been a few areas DOGE has been successful. Data collection's one. There's been this emphasis on knocking down data silos and making massive data sets to be used, especially for Trump's immigration agenda. There's also dozens of lawsuits that allege that data collection is being done illegally. Then there's the push to further downsize the federal workforce and reshape who gets to work in federal government. But the main force behind implementing that part of Trump's agenda is the Office of Management and Budget and its head, Russ Vogt.
So why would Elon Musk leave now?
Well, he says his scheduled time is up. He's talking about his role as a special government employee, time limited to 130 working days. It's been 130 days since Trump took office and Musk took on this role.
Got it.
But he likely could have stayed longer. But politically, Musk is an avatar for the unpopular things DOGE and the second Trump administration have done. He's taken a lot of heat. As Congress is working on trying to pass Trump's big, beautiful bill and other legislative priorities, and we pivot to the midterms, there have been concerns by Republicans that Musk is not helpful.
I think a lot of people who own Tesla stock didn't think he was being very helpful to them.
Well, that's the other part of it. Musk runs multiple big businesses that have suffered because of his split attention and that unpopularity, especially Tesla. That's his main source of wealth. Tesla drivers sold their cars, stores were vandalized, profits cratered, and there were reports that the board was considering replacing him.
Oh, it's like they threatened to fire the guy who was really openly joyful about firing people. I'm thinking of the moment when he stood on stage waving around a chainsaw. Now that just a little time has passed, how is that metaphor working out for him?
Well, Steve, that chainsaw doesn't really have any teeth. I mean, Musk had these lofty savings goals of cutting $2 trillion from before joining the government to a fraction of that to around $150 billion. Our reporting has found those claims are inaccurate, overstated, and rooted in a fundamental misunderstanding of how the federal budget works. Also, DOGE's other signature efforts, like cutting the workforce, have hit repeated legal snags, driven in part by Musk's public statements that have been used to claim those changes broke the law. Put another way, there's little evidence that Elon Musk has done much to make the government more efficient.
Cutting to the facts, NPR's Stephen Fowler. He's part of NPR's team of reporters covering efforts to remake the federal government. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jordan has been a hub for humanitarian aid going to Gaza. There are several reasons for this. The kingdom has a peace treaty with Israel. It's a key ally of the United States. And it's also just a few hours' drive from the Gaza border. All of that made it a useful place from which to stage supplies, supplies that Israel no longer allows to pass into Gaza. NPR's Jane Arraf reports.
In an industrial area on the outskirts of the Jordanian capital, warehouses for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, are packed to the rafters. But there's nothing going in or out. Israel banned all aid from entering Gaza starting in March. It says aid was being stolen by the militant group Hamas. Although the UN and other aid groups say there was no widespread diversion. So just a few hours' drive from the Gaza border, $24 million worth of aid has been stranded at these UNRWA warehouses for months.
We're looking at boxes of food here, which have been sitting here, you know, in some cases since January. And unfortunately, expiry dates are starting to approach.
That's Jonathan Fowler with UNRWA in Jordan.
Some of the food, you know, we're arriving at expiration in July. Flour, you know, we have a quantity of flour here which is due to expire.
200,000 tons of flour, in fact. While some of the other food can potentially be distributed to refugees within Jordan, the flour would likely be dumped. Fowler opens up one of the cardboard boxes. There are lentils, canned fish, chickpeas. And they're similar to more than 100 million meals other aid organizations say they have stuck on the Israeli-Gaza border. Israel cites security reasons for barring aid, but doesn't give details. In the meantime, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of aid paid for through public and private donations, molders and storage. This week, Israel implemented a new U.S.-backed aid plan involving military contractors and delivering limited amounts of food in just four locations.
When you have armed personnel manning humanitarian sites and you have people desperately hungry and in need of aid and not enough aid to meet the need, that's a very volatile combination.
That's Sean Carroll, president of INARA, the biggest U.S.-based non-governmental aid group. Now much of INARA's food is sitting in trucks on the Gaza border. Inside Gaza, even basic supplies like painkillers have run out, says Rachel Norris, a director at Doctors Without Borders. We reached her in Gaza.
You know, it's heartbreaking when I'm in the hospital like I was today and you see children in agony.
The Israeli military asked about the restrictions on aid from Jordan and Egypt, said it had no details. A U.S. State Department spokesperson, speaking anonymously in line with policy, said reports that Israel was barring aid from Jordan or Egypt were absolutely false. In Amman, a truck outside the UNRWA warehouse was loaded with boxes of mattresses. UN staff said it was sent back from the border months ago. Israel didn't explain why. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air, David Leitch on performing and directing dangerous and wild movie stunts. He was a stunt double for Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, and Keanu Reeves. Leitch produced and directed the action comedy film The Fall Guy, which starred Ryan Gosling as a stuntman who has to perform stunts in real life in order to save his life. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Jesse Armstrong has been thinking a lot about billionaires. He's the former showrunner of HBO's Succession, and now he's written and directed a new movie about four uber-rich Silicon Valley types. They've assembled at a mountaintop chateau for what's supposed to be a weekend of poker and conversation.
Four presidents of tech here on Mount Techmore.
Yeah! Meanwhile, the world below them is falling into chaos. They watch news reports of mass executions, governments toppling, all because one of them, Venice, owns a social networking company that's made sharing deepfake videos very easy. Or, as the character played by Rami Youssef puts it,
promoting genocidal, proximate attacks, creating sectarian division with video evidence, massive market instability, fraud.
Okay, so what do these tech gods do about it while watching from high above on their Mount Olympus? Well, that's the question at the heart of Jesse Armstrong's Mountain Head.
When you're on yachts and in private jets and in gated communities, you are physically removed from your fellow human beings. And that physical removal has a psychological effect, I think.
These four characters, these four men, are trying to figure out exactly how the sequence of events happening around the world, how they can take advantage, how they can somehow cash in, profit, get more power. And it just seems like these men have no sense of humanity left. It's like they've become something else. But I guess, you know, when you get to that kind of wealth, there is this godlike air, right? I mean, it just seems like, how could you not? I mean, I would hope I wouldn't, but I don't know, Jesse, is that how that works?
Yeah, I mean, if I was being more generous to them, I think, you know, there's a spectrum of behaviors, right? That on one end you have maybe confidence, which is probably a positive quality and one you need to get through life. And if the extreme version of that is arrogance, and where these characters, there are four of them, where each of them falls on that spectrum, you know, the viewer can decide. But the positive pitch for them is that they think they have the solutions and they would like to apply them to the world, us, and requires a great degree of confidence. And maybe you see when that confidence tips over into arrogance in this film.
Yeah, and they have the solutions, right? But whether we like it or not, or whether we understand what the solution is or not, it seems like it almost doesn't matter how people see their answers, because maybe we're not smart enough to understand them.
Yeah, and you can understand, right? These people, the Sam Altmans of OpenAI and Elon Musk, who also has a big AI division, they are a frontier of knowledge which is shaping our world, and they rightly think that they know more about that on the whole than we do. And so the level of trust that we're being asked to put in them is enormous, and that can make you feel relaxed if you feel comfortable about the character of those people, or it can make you feel nervous if you entertain some anxieties.
The humor definitely comes out in this film of all the characters, in that they are cringy in a way when it comes to their social skills, at least even with each other. There's a lot of cringy moments, but funny cringy moments. How do you balance that humor with some of the more serious elements that are brought up here?
That's how I write. I don't have another gear to shift into, really. So I think that the dark things of the world seem strike me as being often intertwined with the absurd things in the world. And you get a bit of both in this film.
I just want to say this is not on you, Venice.
Obviously, this is not on me. Why would you even say that?
Exactly. This is on the people throwing the firebombs. Should I cancel the DJ out of respect?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, watching a machete cut through human flesh is tough, but you three dancing on a carpet is a real atrocity.
Does being flippant about the chaos happening, that's not really touching them. All they can do is watch it from where they are. Does being flippant about that maybe help them rationalize what they do and why they do it?
Yeah, I guess there's two reasons you can be flippant, right? One is because you don't give a hoot, and one is that you are covering up some sort of psychic damage which is happening deep inside yourself about, you know, your effect on the world. And you know, I'd offer both of those options up for what's going on with these people. I don't think it comes without cost if you're acting on the world, but in the moment they're also I've written a lot of men in my life, and this is another group of four men, and the way they interact, their rankings of each other over money or heart rate and what the temperature in the room is, you know, everything can get reduced to a competitive number, including some pretty big questions.
Yeah. Now, given you went from Succession to this story, so it's obvious, I think, that you are fascinated by billionaires, Jesse. I mean, it just seems like that is something that you really have a beat on. Is this a continuation of some of the themes in Succession, or do you see Mountainhead as a completely different thing altogether?
I think the tone is different. I think you'd agree. You know, we shot it in a similar way, and I gathered around a lot of my colleagues from Succession to help me shoot it. So I think you'll feel, oh, this looks pretty familiar. The tone, I think, as the film develops, is rather different. The concerns remain the same. You know, Succession was really about a family in old media. This is about the media which rules our lives at the moment, and how increasing we get our information via social media and other tech. So this is really a dark comedy. I don't know if you'd agree, more of a dark comedy even than Succession was.
Steve Carell, a great, great actor from The Office and a lot of other things. He plays Randall, who's basically the papa bear, the patriarch of the bunch. One of the things Randall says early on, and it's a quote that I've really thought of over and over again since I saw the film, is the antidote to bad tech is good tech. Because the cat's out of the box, right? When it comes to tech, there's no deceleration, right? I mean, it's full speed ahead, and hopefully sane minds and compassionate minds, I guess, prevail. But I guess who knows?
That's what we've got to hope, right? The government seems to largely have absented itself from the role of being the referee in this area. And the world moves so fast that who knows, even if they did put themselves into the ring, if they would be able to do anything. So you're right. We really have got nothing to do other than hope that these people, to some degree, have the rest of humanity's best interests in mind.
That is Jesse Armstrong. He's following up his HBO show Succession with a movie debuting on HBO Saturday. It's called Mountainhead. Jesse, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
This is NPR News.
What if you didn't actually need to know how to code to make your own app? Maybe now you don't. But then what happens to all the coders?
Coders feel like they are tending kind of organic gardens by hand. But we are producing these superhuman agents that are going to be as good as the best coders in the world, like very, very soon.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How AI could put human coders out of a job on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump welcomes back his close advisor Elon Musk to the White House today. Musk says he is leaving the federal government. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more on what that means for the entity known as the Department of Government Efficiency.
Musk departs DOGE after 130 days marked by legal setbacks, clashes with cabinet members, and little evidence to support claims of savings or government efficiency. Musk's departure won't likely change much. Much of the DOGE work, the parts that haven't been reversed or held up in court at least, have always been done by people embedded in agencies as full-on federal employees. Much of the DOGE work, the parts that haven't been reversed or held up in court at least, has always been done by people embedded in agencies as full-on federal employees. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
Graduation day at Harvard University yesterday, the pomp and circumstance overshadowed by the Ivy League school's legal battles with the White House over funding cuts and attempts to block international student enrollment. Chinese students in particular, like Fang Xiaojiang, are also worried about the administration's much tighter visa restrictions aimed at them.
Many international students on campus are doing this critical work to keep the university running, are making good contribution in academic research, cultural exchanges, ideas exchanges.
China and the U.S. are locked in a trade war. This is NPR News. A civilian employee at the Defense Intelligence Agency is under arrest. He's charged with attempting to provide classified information to a foreign government. NPR's Ryan Lucas with details.
The Justice Department says 28-year-old Nathan Latch was employed for the past 6 years as an IT specialist for the Defense Intelligence Agency. Court documents say that in March 2025, the FBI received a tip after Latch allegedly sent an email to a government friendly to the U.S. offering to provide classified information. In that email, Latch allegedly said he, quote, did not agree or align with the values of the current American administration. An FBI agent posing as a representative of the foreign government responded to Latch, who then on multiple occasions allegedly provided the FBI undercover agent with classified documents. Latch was arrested Thursday after arriving at a prearranged location to allegedly hand over more classified information. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Kentucky's Washington County, where the sheriff's office is advising people to stay home and let emergency workers deal with the damage from a deadly storm. This morning, the National Weather Service issued tornado warnings. Governor Andy Beshear noted reports of at least one twister. U.S. stocks are trading lower this hour. The Dow is down 48 points. S&P's off 16. The Nasdaq is down nearly 100 points. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell, streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Leila Faldil in Budapest. Here in Hungary, Prime Minister Viktor Orban has chipped away at the institutions that make a democracy healthy. One of these institutions crucial to any functioning democracy is the judiciary. Orban and his ruling party have, over the past 15 years, stacked Hungary's courts with loyalists, reduced judges' pay, and limited their freedom of expression. We now bring in NPR's Central Europe correspondent, Rob Schmitz, who has been covering Hungary's democratic backsliding for years. Good morning, Rob.
Morning, Leila.
So, on your last visit to Hungary just before we got here, you spent some time with a judge who saw firsthand how Orban's government stripped the independence from the courts. Why don't you tell us about her?
Yeah, her name is Adrian Lazo, and she's 51 years old. She worked as a criminal judge in Budapest for 24 years. She told me the first changes Orban made to the judiciary were in 2011, when his government suddenly changed the retirement age for all judges. As Lazo told me in our interview in a local cafe, the government changed the retirement age for judges from 70 to 62 years old.
So this meant that all judges between 62 and 70, it was about 300 judges, and they were sent into retirement. And obviously they were the senior judges.
And Leila, as Lazo pointed out, the judges in this group, in this cohort, were among Hungary's most experienced and knowledgeable judges. And forcing 300 of them to retire was a shock to the judicial system because it represented more than 10% of all judges in the country.
I mean, 10%, that's a lot. Who replaced this huge number?
Well, mostly younger, less experienced judges who Lazo says were more loyal to Orban's ruling party. And Lazo says she saw these judges rise through the system faster than anyone else in the judiciary.
There are several judges now at the Curia, which is our Supreme Court, who have very little experience, like 1.5 years as a judge or even less. At the administrative department, there is a judge who used to work for the Ministry of Justice as a state secretary. And from the ministry, he landed directly at the Supreme Court.
So getting these inexperienced judges into place, was this just about getting rid of judges with experience to pave the way for specific policies he wanted to implement?
Right. Yeah. It was basically putting people on the bench who would be loyal to Orban. And, you know, within this short period of time, according to Lazo, suddenly, you know, the most powerful judges in Hungary were these inexperienced political appointees, and they were now all in the position to do Orban's bidding.
But Rob, how was any of this legal?
Well, it actually wasn't. Legal scholars say it violated Hungary's own constitution. 2 years later, the European Court of Justice ruled that Orban had also violated European Union law by doing this. The court forced Hungary to reinstate the judges. Orban's government responded, though, by reestablishing the retirement age to 65, which is in line with the general retirement age throughout the country. But Lazo says the damage to the judiciary was already done because the vacated judges were not given their old posts back. These positions had already been taken by Orban loyalists. Later on, as Orban consolidated more power, his government went even further. It created a special office run by a political appointee responsible for appointing new judges. And then in 2019, it created an entirely new administrative court system that tries cases regarding human rights, elections, asylum cases, and it put that under the executive branch so that Orban could oversee all of it.
So what does this mean for judges like Lazo?
So for Lazo, it meant that she felt she really couldn't live with herself by working in what she saw was an increasingly corrupted system serving a single leader. She struggled for years deciding what she should do.
All the steps that narrowed down the possibilities of being honest and working honestly as a judge were huger and huger, and the pressure over judiciary is increasing by the minute. And after a while, I felt that I can go on with it.
And Leila, last November, Adrian Lazo resigned from the bench. She's now working as a lawyer, and she's trying to raise awareness about the damage that Viktor Orban has done to the country's judicial system.
That's NPR's Central Europe correspondent, Rob Schmitz. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
President Trump's administration has tried several ways to gut the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Now the agency wants to get rid of its own rule that would have stopped medical debt from showing up on credit reports. NPR's Vanessa Romo reports.
The Federal Consumer Protection Watchdog spent nearly 2 years pushing through a new rule about medical debt. The rule would scrub doctor and hospital bills from credit reports and bar lenders from considering medical information when looking at potential borrowers. At the time, the CFPB said the changes would help 15 million Americans and remove about $49 billion in medical debt from records. Now, the agency is led by a Trump appointee, and it's reversed course. The CFPB has not returned NPR's request for comment, but at the end of April, it joined credit industry groups in a lawsuit seeking to undo the rule ever since it was issued in the final weeks of the Biden administration.
Our intention here is to protect the credit reporting system to ensure that it is as complete and accurate as possible.
That's Dan Smith, the CEO and president of the Consumer Data Industry Association, one of the plaintiffs in the suit. He says borrowing and lending are all part of the same ecosystem, that the entire premise of the credit reporting system is to help facilitate more lending to all consumers. So anything short of a comprehensive picture
puts the consumers at risk of default unnecessarily. You do not want to put a consumer into a loan they can't afford.
Smith contends that the previous CFPB exceeded its authority in enacting the rule. And in a legal filing, the agency now says, same.
We believe that Congress is the only one who can act on this and determine whether or not it could be on the credit report.
The prior version of the agency went through a tremendous amount of work and process and time and consideration to put the rule in place.
That's Jennifer Wagner, an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center, which has stepped in to defend the rule on behalf of consumers and other advocacy groups. Wagner argues that by pursuing litigation rather than going through the appropriate notice and comment rulemaking, the new CFPB is trying to eschew the federal guidelines. But in answer to the fundamental question at stake, whether people with medical debt are a bad risk, Wagner says,
lots of studies have found that medical debt is actually not predictive of someone's likelihood of defaulting on a debt. So using that information and credit determinations actually makes no sense.
For now, millions of Americans remain in credit score limbo, waiting to see if their scores might go up before applying for a car loan or a mortgage. They may soon get clarity. Texas's Eastern District Court is expected to make a decision on the case on June 11. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Georgetown scholar Badr Hansouri was held for nearly 2 months by ICE over anti-Semitism accusations he says are baseless. He'll share his story next time, Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Fazan Zaki, the seventh grader from Dallas, won the Scripps Spelling Bee. His winning word was éclaircissement, a French noun meaning clearing up of something obscure. Spell it with me, E-C-L-A-I-R-C-I-S-S-E-M-E-N-T. Hopefully that's an éclaircissement of the word. Ask what he'll do next. Zaki said he'll probably stay up all night. C-O-N-G-R-I-T-S. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The latest witness in the criminal trial of Sean Combs is a woman going by the pseudonym Mia. She's a former employee of the hip-hop star and executive. This story includes descriptions of violence and sexual assault, and for those who need to go away, it lasts about 4 minutes. Mia is the second witness to accuse Combs of having physically and sexually assaulted her. His charges in this federal trial include sex trafficking and racketeering, and he has pleaded not guilty. NPR culture correspondent Anastasia Siolkis has been reporting from the federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan. Anastasia, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So who is Mia and what did she say?
Mia worked closely with Sean Combs for about 8 years. She began as a personal assistant in 2009. And she testified that over time, Combs physically and sexually assaulted her multiple times, including allegedly raping her, forcing her to perform oral sex on him, and repeatedly slamming a heavy door in her arm until she thought it was broken on one occasion. And she said she was convinced no one would believe her and that he was simply too powerful. She said, quote, "I couldn't tell him no about a sandwich. I couldn't tell him no about anything." And she also said she had a couple of interactions with police officers in which they were clearly so dazzled by Combs' celebrity, she decided that to never go to authorities.
Okay, so how does her testimony fit in with, compare with, the testimony of another major witness, Capricorn Clark, who also had been one of Sean Combs' assistants?
So Capricorn Clark was on the stand earlier this week, and she talked about feeling a huge power imbalance between herself and Combs, as well as Mia did. But Capricorn Clark's specific allegations are quite different. Clark testified Combs and his associates had repeatedly threatened to kill her, including over an incident in which Combs suspected her of stealing some diamond jewelry. Clark quit working for Combs repeatedly over 14 years, but said she was just unable to secure another job in the music industry, so she kept coming back. And Clark also testified that Combs kidnapped her with a gun during a very chaotic incident in December of 2011, in which Combs allegedly attempted to confront the musician Scott Mascody, who's better known as the musician Kid Cudi. And Kid Cudi was dating Combs' on-and-off girlfriend at the time, the singer Cassie Ventura.
Okay, so two really important witnesses, compelling witnesses. Who else has been testifying?
This week, the jury also heard from an L.A. Police Department officer as well as an L.A. Fire Department arson investigator. They gave more context around Kid Cudi's testimony. He was on the stand last week.
Right.
And the jury also heard from a stylist named Deontay Nash, who really corroborated, that was his purpose on the stand, was to corroborate Cassie Ventura's testimony about abuse and control under Sean Combs. And it is also worth noting, I think, Steve, that in addition to their own allegations against Combs, both this woman going under the name Mia and Capricorn Clark also testified that they heard or saw alleged abuse of Cassie Ventura. And with many of the witnesses this week, the prosecution seems to be driving home to the jury this idea that there was a web of people insulating Combs. And Mia is going to be returning to the stand this morning.
Allegedly a web of people insulating Combs and also a lot of people harmed by Combs, according to the prosecution case. Anastasia, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Anastasia Siolkis has been in court watching the trial. This is NPR News. We'll be right back. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Budapest. Both Prime Minister Viktor Orban here in Hungary and President Trump spend a lot of time trashing the press for being fake, biased, left-wing. And when Orban returned to power 15 years ago, he and his party, Fidesz, decided to do something about what they perceived as media imbalance. Boris Kalnoky is a Fidesz supporter and the head of the School of Media at the state-funded Matthias Corvinus Collegium, or MCC.
What Fidesz concluded is that they will never stand a chance of being on a stable footing politically if they don't get the even playing field in the media. And so there was a conscious decision to try and change it.
Kalnoky asserts that Orban was simply trying to level the playing field, calling on private businessmen to establish outlets with Christian democratic viewpoints.
So the aim was never to completely dominate the media market. The aim was to produce maybe a 50-50 balance.
Journalists and organizations like the Committee to Protect Journalists dispute that. They point to a new law working its way through parliament that they say would wipe out the remaining independent press in Hungary, like at Lazo. It's the only watchdog investigative outlet in Hungary. Journalists report on corruption, bogus contracts, the use of state funds. After their weekly editorial meeting, editor-in-chief Tomasz Boduki leads us into his office. He points to a map by his desk where he says his team tracked a yacht Orban and his inner circle use.
They were using it totally secretly, so we had the foreign minister pictured on the yacht while he was posting on Facebook pictures from his office in suit working. So it was a big scandal.
Like most independent nonprofits in Hungary, Atlazo gets international grants and support. It's half the budget. Now Boduki worries this kind of investigative journalism may soon go dark.
The so-called Sovereignty Protection Office will blacklist organizations and ban them from accepting any kind of foreign funding.
Hungarians were expecting something big was coming when Prime Minister Viktor Orban called for a spring clean in a fiery speech back in March.
Felszámoljuk az egész árnyék hadsereget. Ők a mi újkori labancaink, a brüsszeli kegyencek, akik hazájuk ellenében pénzért a birodalom szekerét tolják.
He vowed to go after what he called a shadow army of political opponents, journalists, activists, and judges working for foreign powers. And many say he's now making good on that promise through this transparency law that the government says is meant to protect Hungary's sovereignty from foreign influence. But the definition of what that threat is vague. There's mention of unity, the family, biological gender, the Christian culture. It also says it will specifically target activities capable of influencing public opinion. The consequences would be the blacklisting, but also raids, costly fines of up to 25 times the international funding received, and possible dissolution of the organization itself.
So what are you going to do?
We have some reserves built up in the last 15 years, so we still have some runway, and we will try to get this law cancelled, or we will try to go to court.
Kalnoky, the head of the School of Media at MCC, says if these places can't survive without international support, maybe they shouldn't.
My definition of independent media is financial independence. If you need money from sources other than your consumers, then you're not independent. If you take funding from NGOs, foreign governments, embassies, Google, taxpayer money, the EU, then I would argue you are not independent. You're financially dependent on money that does not come from you being able to sell your product.
Orban's supporters see this as him protecting Hungary from nefarious actors beyond its border. But his detractors say he's copying Russia. There, President Vladimir Putin used a foreign agent law to demonize and force civil society into submission.
Southwest Airlines has a new rule for passengers. The airline requires passengers to keep battery packs and other portable charging devices visible when using them in flight. Southwest says this is a safety measure so crew members can more easily respond to possible fires.
It could be a laptop, it could be a cell phone, it could be a power pack that we all typically use when we're traveling. So anything literally powered by a lithium-ion battery could be problematic.
Anthony Brickhouse is an aerospace safety consultant.
Sometimes those batteries can overheat or experience something that we call thermal runaway, which could result in them catching on fire.
We had so many questions about this policy, one of them being how easily can it be enforced? If the thing is out of sight, it's out of sight. But in any case, there's the other question, which is how big a risk are lithium batteries on planes? Well, since the start of this year, there have been 22 verified incidents of those batteries catching fire or smoking or overheating, according to the FAA. David Roth is director of the Thermal Runaway Incident Program at UL Standards and Engagement, a nonprofit working on safety.
But the other side of that is there are 180,000 airline flights each week. So it is a rare situation, but having a fire at 35,000 feet is very scary.
Roth says Southwest's new policy means that help can come faster if something goes wrong. Some good news is there are people working to make batteries in our devices less of a risk. People like Kelsey Hatzel, who's a mechanical and aerospace engineer at Princeton.
The holy grail of materials for a battery is a lithium metal anode. So that's where I think the batteries are going. Lithium metal or silicon anodes are going to be really game-changing for increasing the energy density of a battery and eliminating the need to carry so many extra charging devices around, because then your battery will last longer.
I hope she gets a real charge out of her work. It's energizing.
Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come on, fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up.
But leave the battery out. It's Morning Edition for NPR News, theme music inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fox.